Hey everybody, welcome to the Surgery Set. I'm Jonathan Kohler, an assistant professor of pediatric surgery here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, home of the Badgers. This is a podcast about surgery and the people who are at the cutting edge of it. We're glad you're here.
Thank you for joining us on the Surgery Set podcast. My name is Angie Ingraham, and I'm an assistant professor of surgery at the University of Wisconsin. And I have the pleasure today of interviewing Dr. Tyler Hughes. Dr. Hughes graduated from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School in Dallas. He completed his residency at St. Paul Medical Center in Dallas and served as an assistant program director there. After his time in Dallas, he moved to McPherson, Kansas to pursue a rural surgical career. In Kansas, he is a clinical faculty member at the Kansas University School of Medicine and was named an outstanding preceptor in 2010. Most notably, Dr. Hughes was named National Rural Health Association Rural Health Practitioner of the Year in 2012, and in 2012 was also selected out of 65 candidates to be a director of the American Board of Surgery. And so, Dr. Hughes, it's a pleasure to have you at the University of Wisconsin, and we're so grateful for your talk today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So I'd like to just start out by asking you about the concept of having more medical students and residents train in rural communities, which is obviously an important part to have that pipeline to fill rural surgery positions. How do we incentivize the rural surgeons to take on those trainees, and how do we repay them for their efforts?
Interestingly, I hear this a lot about how do we compensate the rural surgeon for their mentorship and teaching. Perhaps it's because of their nature or because of they feel the great need for their replacements. That actually, at least in Kansas, our faculties volunteer and they enjoy doing it. We do have some that say, I'm just too busy, it slows me down. But actually, the financial end of it hasn't been that restrictive. It's been more who is able to teach well. Do they have enough clinical load? Because you hate to send a student out for a month and they do three cases. Mm-hmm. One thing that they really are good at is teaching endoscopy. Mm-hmm. And I know nationally that's a big deal. The rural surgeons, just they're always got their hands up. Send them to me. I'll give them 100 every month.
Right.
Now, I think as it becomes more codified, you know, a system becomes more codified, you're going to have to find some way of compensating at least some of that time. And my thought would be that who really benefits from this are the hospitals, because they know that without the next generation of surgeons, they're going to close. So I think engaging the hospital systems and hospital networks to say, let's have a fund of money that's allocated both to the housing of the students as well as the training costs. You'll never be able to pay a surgeon what they're worth per minute of time.
Right.
But I think generally, you know, I'm talking off the cuff here, but I think most general surgeons love to teach. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, they practically drag their patients into the exam room and teach them all about the operation. And the patients go, well, I just wanted to know if you were going to take out my appendix.
Right.
So I think there's this huge well of people who would both volunteer and for relatively minimal amounts. One last part of that question, we have a huge number of surgeons who are about to retire. This is a pool of experience that's deep. They are not antiquated. They are not out of date. And they do not want to just go quietly into the night. These men and women will take infinitely less money as a staff teacher than they would as an RVU clinician provider. So I think another area to target is look at the retired or just about to retire surgeon, offer them a third of what they make in practice to be three-quarters time teaching. And I bet you're going to get a whole lot of, well, yeah, I'll do that.
Yeah, that would be wonderful. Yeah, I did my residency at Cincinnati, and during our third year, we would go to Gallup, East Ohio, which is about 2 hours away from Cincinnati, for usually about 2 months at a time. And we spent that time at the Holzer Clinic. And we were the only resident there. So the operator said, you know, you're paging the resident, you're paging us. but housing was a huge part of that, but we got to live in the little yellow house that was next door to Mrs. Holzer's house. And so I think it's just making all those components of that rotation or that experience work from both the surgeon side as well as the medical student or resident
side. Yeah, you got to make it a happy experience.
Right.
The worst thing to do is to show up in a small town and say, oh, you're here. Well, I don't know what you're supposed to do today.
Right.
You've got to set up the rotation for success. And I think the home faculty that's sending needs to have a good relationship with that person out in the hinterland. And there are just enormous benefits. For me, when I was doing this in McPherson, you know, I knew half a dozen clinical professors that I could call. Mm-hmm. And they, we know Tyler. He's out there in McPherson. He wouldn't call us unless it was important. And it makes a world of difference. I think we all have an ego issue when it comes to asking for help because, you know, we're surgeons, supposed to be, you know, perfect in every way. So it's really nice to have a professor in your pocket that says, yeah, I'd probably send that on over, or no, you can do that. It'll be fine. If there's a problem, give me a call.
What do you think is the role of telemedicine in rural surgery?
Well, I think we could be doing great things in telemedicine. A quick example is, say, I have a bad trauma case, I get them stabilized and send them to you. You do the typical 3-day trauma admission, but, you know, they're banged up with several different things. And you can send them back to me and have their post-op appointment in my office with a telemedicine hookup. And I could easily look over the patient, and if you're in clinic, hit the button and say, Angie, this is the case you did last week. Here's what the wound looked like. I think we ought to open it. You know, no offense, I'm sure you never get an infection, but, or, you know, what did you do in here because the patient's saying that they're still vomiting? Yeah, it picks up the impending disaster that can be easily diverted away where it's now not a disaster. Because I see all too often trauma and tertiary surgery centers, these people come back to our hometown, I don't even have been operated on, and then they bounce into the ER with a complication. And the tertiary facility person is not on call or, yeah. You know, I don't know who they are. But by using telemedicine and creating a kind of mutual clinic. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the problem with telemedicine. It's not about the money.
Right.
But it's about the money.
Yeah.
People don't get paid for telemedicine.
Right. Right.
Even worse, if you're, you know, say you have a clinic on the Missouri side, even though you're a TAU physician, and you cross that state line, you got to have a license.
Right.
So what we really need is some advocacy to take away the amount of money that could be saved this system through these kind of appointments.
Yeah.
And I'm not talking just about the money of convenience.
Right.
I think I saw a study out of Nebraska or Nevada somewhere where they were doing a lot of telemedicine follow-up or even preoperative visits to make sure they're ready to go to the big city. And the cost in savings of gasoline would have more paid than all the telemedicine equipment. Now, of course, the patient doesn't give you their gas money in exchange for the telemedicine. But if you talk about societal impact, you know, this is a way to have great societal impact. You have a surgeon at one end who can do the touch and feel, a surgeon at the other end who has, you know, experience or previously operated on a patient. What could be better?
Right. Yeah, I think it points to all those things that we as surgeons don't always take into account for people who are coming from more rural areas in terms of the time off, the dedication of their families to get them to appointments at times, all those other indirect things that you talked about in your talk that we don't always account for when people are making these.
Yeah, you can bet, let's say you see a kid in your office for follow-up, and you can bet that 10 or 15 minutes you spend, which is important, you know, you need to see the patient. Not because they're going to have a problem, but because it reinforces that I did this one, it went well, I'll do that again. But that 10 or 15 minutes that's very important that you spend with represents perhaps a day off work for one or both parents, probably $25 in gas each way, and then whatever lost wages that day or sick time that now is spent on the kid. And if you take that from a rural environment where pickings are slim, as we say down there, you may drive them right off the financial cliff for something simple.
So as an acute care surgeon, or emergency general surgeon, I sometimes have patients who are transferred to my tertiary center and I operate on them and I control their sepsis or their intradominal catastrophe. What are your thoughts on then having that patient acutely go back to that initial referring hospital for the rest of their care, because I think sometimes I don't want to give up the control of that patient, but at the same time, their family then is now trying to straddle this, trying to be there for the family member, but then they're miles away from their home. And how do we best promote the recovery of that patient in an appropriate environment?
Yeah. And again, it's not about the money, but
it's about the money.
Because the receiving surgeon is going to get none of your professional fees. And we're in a global period, aren't we? So how does that surgeon get compensated for his time? This is personal opinion on my part, but anytime another surgeon asks me to help care for a patient, I'm just going to do that.
Right.
And I think that's part of developing this real tie, as opposed to, well, I hear Dr. Hughes is in your town, go see him and have him give me a call. That doesn't work. But if you call me up and say, you know, I did this case, I'd like you to do so-and-so, with the proviso that I go, okay, so I look at the patient and there's a hole and there's bad fluid coming out of it. One of us is going to do an operation.
Right.
Either you'll let me do the follow-up operation because it's the right thing for the patient, or I'm going to say, yeah, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is going to go well here, and send it back to you. I mean, that's sort of a mutually beneficial thing. I don't know. What do you suppose the reoperation rate in serious acute care surgery is? 5 or 10%?
Yeah.
So, you know, if 5 or 10% of the kind of lesser follow-up operations are done locally, well, maybe we can solve that money problem a little bit. We also need to erase the stigma that you didn't do it, so you shouldn't have to do it.
Right.
Let's talk about what the patient needs. No, I don't want to drain somebody else's abscess.
Right.
On the other hand, if you think for just a moment what my convenience versus what the patient's convenience is, then it makes sense to do that. And I think with a good working relationship with the acute care surgeon or emergency surgeon at the bigger place, that can work. But it's not so much policy as it is personal effort on the side of each rural surgeon and the center surgeon.
So I just had a case recently where the patient had had a complication of a procedure, and the rural surgeon had wanted to take that patient back to the operating room, which is what they needed, but the operating room wasn't operating on Saturday at that hospital where the patient was at, and so they ended up having to transfer. So how much do you see, or are you hearing from rural surgeons that they want to, you know, take care of their patients, but their situations or their surrounding or their hospital isn't allowing them to do so?
Now, my personal experience hasn't been that so much. There are a lot of places where the surgeon is only in town certain days, you know, to really small places. This is what I was talking about, having a proper infrastructure. If we can set up, you know, some standards so that we know these are places that will do it 24/7, these are places that will do it 60% of the time, and maybe the answer is not to come all the way back to the center, but to come to the next intervening place that is operating on Saturday. That's what a network is,
right?
And the surgeon might even have privileges at that next town over that's maybe just 20 miles away.
Right.
And develop a team that works across a region. That's what regionalization is.
Right.
As opposed to centralization, which is, oh, we can't do it here, go to the big place.
Right.
And which usually doesn't work out so well, because even if you're operating on Saturday, those 4 gunshot wounds and 3 MBAs are in front, as they should be.
Right.
Now, that's what you're supposed to do, is you're supposed to do the hard stuff that requires, you know, standing on your head to get it right. And we're supposed to do the body of work with your assistants and vice versa. So I think we need to develop that rapport. You know, it's the St. Elsewhere syndrome, isn't it? You know, whatever was done elsewhere must be wrong because you don't know them. You know, we got to get to know each other.
How do you see that regionalization of surgery developing as opposed to that centralization? How can we kind of promote that regionalization strategy? Because there are so many moving parts and so many players, and, you know, between insurances and hospital systems and all those types of things.
Yeah, it's not the money. I think we often underestimate our influence as surgeons. When we step into the C-suite or to the legislator's office and say, look, this is what's right for the patient, that's where we're actually still respected in that regard. Not so much when we say, look, I'm not getting paid for this, I want you to pay me for it, but say, look, we want to establish a rural surgical network. But let's us as surgeons define it. Let's us as surgeons get together and say to the policymakers, if you will do this, we promise to do that. And then the law gets written the way we want it to,
right?
Rather than the way someone who's never done surgery thinks it ought to be done. So I think leadership within a state and region of surgeons, and you know, there are all sorts of organizations that want a finger in this pie.
Right.
Most places have a state chapter of the American College of Surgeons, good place to start. But if you don't have that network, four or five surgeons get together and start talking to four or five other surgeons, and you can do it mostly by phone.
Right.
But then, now you walk into that governor's office and say, and not only this will win you the love of 5 million registered voters.
Right.
You know, all of a sudden you have their attention.
Right.
So I think that's, we need to assert the leadership that we naturally possess. The trouble is we usually assert it just in the OR or in our hospital. Got to think beyond the hospital walls if we're going to solve this problem.
I think, and what you said in your talk is so important. It's, you know, people aren't necessarily getting paid for that advocacy work that, you know, needs to be done. It's time that they're taking, you know, out of their OR schedule, you know, if they're a general surgeon. And so recognizing the value of that is important.
Yeah. And, you know, I keep saying it's not the money, but I'm telling you, no money for advocacy, no results.
Right.
It's just like L.D. Britt saying about no access, no quality. You know, we have to have access to the policymakers. Some like contributions, but a lot of it is just having someone who can take the time without crippling themselves economically to put forward the logical, altruistic goals that we actually want. Because most of the stuff is not about, well, we're not paid enough. The surgeons are pretty well paid. It's a, we don't understand why we can't get to do this stuff because we think it could be better. Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we might make more money as a result, but that's not a crime. You know, the point is to do something good. And if you get paid more for it, hey, that's great.
Right. Well, thank you for your thoughts and your wise advice. And I hope that you have a wonderful day at the University of Wisconsin.
Already have. This is one of the best places I can imagine for someone to go. And I'm just so pleased to be here.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you enjoy the Surgery Set or have suggestions on how we can make our program better, please provide us with your feedback. You can rate our podcast and leave your comments on iTunes, Podbean, or Stitcher, or you can send us an email at podcast@surgery.wisc.edu. It's really helpful to get those comments and ratings because they increase our visibility to other people who haven't heard about us. Join me next time when I sit down and talk with Dr. Brian Zuckerbraun. He's a surgeon scientist at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Zuckerbraun briefly discusses his research on carbon monoxide, believe it or not, as a medical therapy, and also discusses the ways in which clinical work can impact a basic science lab.
Yeah, I think, you know, the first time people hear carbon monoxide, they automatically think toxicity and, you know, the stories that come out on the news. And I think that's founded. But again, this is a isolated, very pure carbon monoxide as a medical therapy, just as you would consider any other drug therapy or inhaled gas-based therapy. And
The Surgery Set is a production of the Department of Surgery at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. This episode was produced by Veronica Watson and myself. It was recorded by Chris Hansen and edited by Alex Worley. Our theme song is On Wisconsin, arranged and produced by Jamie Schmidt. I encourage you to visit us at surgery.wisc.edu, where you can find links to grand rounds, free CME credits, and more. You can also check out the UW School of Medicine and Public Health video library for a wide range of medical education resources at videos.med.wisc.edu. In addition, you can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes, Podbean, and Stitcher, and of course you can follow us on social media. You can like our Facebook page and also find us on Twitter at Wisc Surgery or at J.E. Kohler, that's K-O-H-L-E-R. Please feel free to let us know how we're doing and don't hesitate to let us know of any topics you'd like us to cover. Thanks, we hope you check back soon. On Wisconsin.